Good morning, all. Before we call the first case, I want to just make a short announcement that Judge Mannion and I are pleased and privileged to have sitting with us this morning Judge Magnus Stinson of the Southern District of Indiana, and we are grateful for her willingness to serve.
Thank you.
All right, the first case for argument this morning is North Shore versus Progressive Casualty. Mr. Ceci?
May it please the Court. The dispute in this case resolves around whether North Shore Bank is entitled to coverage under Insuring Agreement E of Progressive's financial institution bond. And the coverage question here turns on two separate issues. First, whether the certificate of origin that Russell Ott submitted to North Shore Bank to obtain the loan in question was a counterfeit, as that term is used in the bond. And second, whether North Shore Bank exercised good faith in making the loan to Ott. Because the answer to both of those questions is yes, North Shore Bank respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court's entry of summary judgment in favor of Progressive and grant summary judgment in favor of North Shore Bank. Now, on the issue of counterfeit, the bond specifically states that counterfeit means a written imitation of an actual valid original which is intended to be to deceive and to be taken as the original. And the specific language within that definition that has caused, has been the source of much dispute here, is the part that says imitation of an actual valid original. Note what that language does not say. It does not say a perfect imitation of an actual valid original. But the district court's decision in Progressive's argument is essentially trying to read that new requirement into the terms of the bond. According to Progressive, Ott's certificate of origin cannot possibly imitate an actual valid certificate of origin because there is no real motorhome with the VIN number that's contained within the fake certificate of origin. So under Progressive's reasoning, the VIN in the certificate of origin must perfectly match the VIN in the VIN number of an existing vehicle. But Progressive's reading requirements into the bond that aren't found in the bond itself. I think the other point here is that Progressive's argument also ignores the specific manner in which Ott accomplished his fraud in this case. Now, at the time that Ott presented the fake certificate of origin to North Shore Bank, he also presented an actual, real, existing motorhome that had an altered VIN plate on it that matched up perfectly with the VIN plate that was also, with the VIN number that was also contained in the fake certificate of origin.
Now, the bank didn't have a secured interest as a result of all of this, did it?
It did not.
And, of course, they get the title from the state based on the certificate of origin. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes, and I didn't mean to cut Your Honor off.
No,
but
no, I'm just trying to clarify this because this is part of the problem. Obviously, you loan, $400,000-some. You would hope to have security, a secured interest in something, and there is nothing there.
I would distinguish it a little bit. There was something there. There was an actual, real motorhome. We took pictures of it. We walked through it. We started it up. It exists.
Another bank had a secured interest in that motorhome and foreclosed on it.
It did. That's true. It's that the paperwork that was submitted, because the VIN number in the fake certificate of origin did not match up to the VIN number for the actual vehicle that we inspected, the bank had no security interest. And so the operative language here from the perspective of the bank is not whether or not there is an actual motorhome in existence with the VIN number that's contained within that fake certificate of origin. But the question is whether the fake certificate of origin, which is the document in question, imitates something that actually exists, that is real and that actually exists. And North Shore Bank submits that even though this fake certificate of origin contained a VIN number that did not exist, it still imitated a real, valid, original document because it imitated the certificate of origin for the motorhome, the $400,000-some-odd motorhome that was on the bank's lot.
Counsel, the VIN number difference isn't the only difference between what might have looked like an original from Beaver, is it?
It is not. It is not the only difference. There were different, and those are articulated in the briefs. It is not the only difference. I think the main focus here has been on the VIN number because I think that was the primary focus of the district court opinion. And in the district court, if I'm recalling correctly, might have referred to it as the coup de grace. The fact that the VIN number in the fake certificate of origin wasn't a VIN number for a real motorhome. But the question here is really one of imitation. And the way that we've put it in the brief is, if Russell Ott wasn't trying to imitate the valid original certificate of origin for the motorhome that the bank inspected on October 30, 2006, why would he have made sure that the actual existing motorhome had a VIN plate that corresponded precisely with the fake certificate of origin? It's our position that there was no reason to do that other than Ott was presenting the fake certificate of origin as the real certificate of origin for the real motorhome that existed. Now, it turns out not to be true. I mean, if it were the real certificate of origin for the motorhome that existed, we wouldn't be here. We'd have a security interest and we wouldn't be seeking coverage under insuring agreement E. But the language that's controlling here is the imitation of an actual valid original, and it's our position that the facts speak directly to that. And in reality, I could have no other purpose but to have the fake certificate of origin serve as an imitation when he alters the VIN plate on the vehicle so that it matches the fake certificate of origin.
You mentioned that it doesn't, if it had matched exactly the actual VIN number, we wouldn't be here. Is that what you said?
Right.
Is it possible for someone to get a second title? If for instance, that was an 02 or 03? But what was the year of the one that was actually sitting there?
2003.
So
yes,
obviously another bank had a security interest in that. If he had said it was identical, and we're talking about a counterfeit that was identical to the certificate of origin, would your bank be able to secure a title to that if it sent it in? They go through the same process that you got the title of the non-existent one. I'm just wondering if there's a way to tell if somebody else already has a lien on that motorhome, if it were the correct VIN number.
Well, I can say that there's no evidence in the record on that, but I think it's fairly safe to assume that if Ott had submitted the paperwork with the real VIN number for the vehicle that was inspected, the motorhome that was inspected, It's safe to assume that at least the state of Illinois should have caught on to the fact that there was already a secured interest in that vehicle prior to issuing the certificate of title that it issued. So at that point, the jig would have been up. And so I think in closing on the point of counterfeit, the thing that distinguishes this case from the other cases that have been presented in the briefs is that here you have an actual physical existing thing. The motorhome exists, and the fake certificate of origin was designed to imitate the real certificate of origin for that motorhome exists. This isn't a case of invoices for non-existent transactions. There's an actual thing that exists. It was that motorhome that we inspected.
Counsel, the trial judge indicated that it was undisputed that there was never any actual valid original certificate of origin. What's your response to his finding that was an undisputed fact?
I think that is disputed. We've submitted in both the district court and I think the record here reflects as well that the affidavit of Michael Hayes contains a copy of the certificate of origin for the vehicle that we believe was actually inspected on October 30th, 2006. And I think even if the court disagrees that the certificate of origin submitted with Mr. Hayes' affidavit was the actual certificate of origin for the vehicle that was inspected, we know there's a vehicle. We know that there's a vehicle. We've got pictures of it. We walked through it, started it up, et cetera. And so we know that because there's an actual physical existing vehicle, that vehicle had to have a certificate of origin. So if it's not the certificate of origin that's attached to the affidavit of Michael Hayes, it's some other certificate of origin. Now, I think it would be a pretty big leap to conclude that it wasn't the 2003 motorhome that was inspected. When you take into consideration, we also submitted an affidavit of the repossession company, and there was only one motorhome repossessed from Russell Ott's lot that matched up with the paintings of the animals on the back of it, such that it would have correlated to this specific motorhome. The other thing is there's an email in the record, too, where our investigator, through the process of speaking with the FBI and investigating the existence and trying to obtain the actual vehicle, came across and discovered that what happened is there's an actual 2003 that was on the lot. There's a title that was submitted with that as well. I guess the short answer is I think the district court just has it wrong when he says that there's...
this loan is over $400,000, is it not?
It is.
Could the bank have done anything more?
Could they have done anything more?
Well, for example, if you'd lent $400,000 on a piece of real estate, would the bank likely to examine to see that the real estate existed and the home existed on the loan?
My candid response to that, Your Honor, is I don't know what the exact procedures are for what the due diligence is in entering into a real estate transaction like that. And I
what
think
about in a motorhome.
Oh yeah. Oh, but I'm talking about the motorhome. And I think it's two separate answers. Could they have done it? Yes, they could have. There was nothing out there in the world preventing them from doing it. But the question at issue in this case is, did they have a duty to do it?
Yeah. And, well, there's some case law, is there not, that suggests that insurers don't want lenders to be, slovenly is, I think, one of the words used in the approach in these cases. And I'm not concluding that should have been done, but I'm just suggesting there's some case law.
If you're done with your question, I'll answer because you're right. And there is an indication in the case law that banks should be motivated to confirm the existence of the collateral. I think that's the general principle you're talking about. And that's exactly what distinguishes this case from the Capital Bank case and other cases where you have non-existent invoices. We confirmed the existence of the collateral. We confirmed that something existed. It just so happened that...
How did you confirm that?
Because we confirmed that there was an actual physical motorhome that we walked through. That's
my anchor. How did you do that?
Yeah.
Physically do that?
Bill Hins was the loan officer that closed the loan on this bank, and he traveled from North Shore's office in Wisconsin to the location of this dealership in Illinois, and he took pictures of the motorhome. He walked through it.
He just didn't look at the VIN number.
He did look at the VIN number. No, the testimony is unequivocal on that. He did look at the VIN number. He testified that he looked down, I believe it was behind one of the front seats, and confirmed that the VIN number that was in the vehicle matched up with the VIN number on the paperwork.
It matched up with the phony certificate.
It matched up with the phony certificate.
We have in our record here a copy of the actual certificate of origin.
Yes.
And that's the difference. And I would be curious to know, it doesn't matter here, but if this had been duplicated and identical, and that's where we would have a counterfeit, at least the way we look at it. This is the real one, and they had one that looked exactly like it that was the counterfeit. Now, obviously, this certificate that's the fake doesn't look exactly like it because of those three numbers in the VIN number that differ.
I don't disagree with that. You're right. It does not look exactly like it. And if so, if the obstacle or the barometer for coverage is, does it have to look exactly like it? We don't meet that. It doesn't have to look exactly like it. What our focus is in our position is that it has to be an imitation, and it has to be an imitation that's good enough to fool a banker.
But counsel, it didn't even look. It wasn't even the same format as the certificates of origin that were issued by Beaver, was it?
Well, I
mean,
don't
it didn't have the Beaver. It had an electronically signed name. It didn't have a hand signature. It had a whole series of different differences. And so I guess my question is, what did he do to determine that the certificate of origin was legitimate? Did he call Beaver and say, can you just give me a facsimile of what they look like for that year?
He did not do that.
Okay.
No. And I think that there's no question that he did not do that and that there are differences in the way that these two certificate of origins look. What I would submit is that there is no evidentiary basis in the record for the proposition that a bank, in order to exercise due diligence, has to make that call. And there are accusations about things we didn't do and things that we could have done. But if what we're talking about here are actual obligations, Progressive could have very easily submitted the affidavit if there was an expert out there who was willing to submit one, saying that here is the standard. Here you have to. I see that my time's up. Can I finish that sentence, or should, okay? The point is that you have to have somebody with an exhaustive background in analyzing certificate of origins, or you have to have somebody with a book of representative exemplars, and if not, that breaches the standard. We don't have that evidence here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Mr. Galbois?
May it please the Court. If I may, I'd like to go to a question that Judge Magnus Stinson threw out there, and I think, because it cuts to the right to the question of the threshold issue here, and I just want to clarify something. There never was an actual valid certificate of origin for a 2007 Beaver Marquis motorhome. That is undisputed. I think what counsel is arguing is that there was perhaps a valid 2003 certificate of origin, but I want to be clear, there never was an actual valid certificate of origin for the 2007 Beaver Marquis motorhome, and that is dispositive in this case. Case law in this circuit, and for 40 years throughout the majority of cases in the federal and state courts, have come to the same conclusion, and that to be an imitation, to be a counterfeit imitation, it has to be an imitation of an actual valid certificate of origin. The reason why there was one that never issued in this case is because Beaver Marquis Motorhome never manufactured a 2007 Beaver Marquis Motorhome as reflected or described in the counterfeit 2007 certificate. That's dispositive. That's what the court found here, and it's consistent with the basic rationale behind the counterfeit definition that is recognized, again, throughout the country. That rationale is simple. It is a financial institution bond isn't meant to indemnify for all loan losses. In fact, there's an exclusion on that point. It's only supposed to cover what is a defined counterfeit. And the definition and the rationale behind the counterfeit definition is to allocate business risks, a risk that a bank can reasonably anticipate or if confirmed, such as verify the representations in a loan document, is the bank's risk. And that's what we have here. The bank failed to make any effort to verify any of the contents in the fake 2007 certificate. And moreover, since it never made such effort, it failed to even act in good faith, and that is our second point. The district court could have gotten there, but it only had to address the threshold issue of whether it was a counterfeit. Had it gone even further, though, the district court could have said that the bank acknowledges that this was an anomalous transaction. It's in its own papers. In fact, it's in its own complaint that this was a somewhat unique transaction that required extra care. The bank saw the red flag here, and the reason why it required extra care, because Russell Ott was on both sides of the underlying transaction. He was the buyer and the seller of the motorhome. He was buying it from his own dealership. That means that the counterfeit certificate of origin was coming from him.
What was the supposed value of the 2007 motorhome that supposedly was being purchased?
Your Honor, I'm going to make an estimate here. I believe it was either in the high 400,000s or low 500,000s.
I thought it was a little higher than that, but I could be wrong. But it was not the same amount that was borrowed, was it?
Correct, Your Honor. The retail...
I guess the banker would... I don't know what they do when they loan money for that sort of thing. But if it had actually been a genuine certificate that was a counterfeit, what could happen? All right, let's say it's a counterfeit, and then the bank gets the counterfeit and makes the loan. Then I guess they send this to the state. Is it up to the state to say, you know, we already got one?
You know, in this circumstance, Judge, if there was, I can't speak for what the state actually does, but I would also want to just make one point of record. There's been an argument by the bank that somehow the state serves as a safeguard here, that the state somehow inspects these things generally or would inform if they have a duplicate already on file. There's no evidence in the record that the state does anything but essentially process this, receive a certificate of origin, and then issue title. So to answer the judge's question, I'm not sure what the state does, but there's no evidence of the record to support their claim that the state somehow serves as a safeguard for the bank's own underwriting.
I guess it's a question of how you maintain a secured interest. And of course, if you get a title, theoretically at least, that's your secured interest. But if you find out somebody else has the title, then you go to court and they find out this one's a lot older than that one, and you win, or something like that. I guess that's what would be insured. Is that right?
If it was an imitation of an authentic certificate of origin,
what you would call a genuine counterfeit.
Correct.
And that's when the surety would come in and bail out the bank.
That's precisely correct, Your Honor. Exactly. But there are a plethora of cases that we've referred to, obviously, that when someone in Mr. Ott's position, what they're attempting to do is to make a counterfeit document appear as precisely as what they think an original may appear. And in those cases, however, when a document is a complete fabrication and, in fact, doesn't imitate an authentic document, courts have said that's not a counterfeit. It can't be a counterfeit because it's not imitating anything. It's just a complete fabrication. The certificate of origin in this case was as much of a fabrication as the motorhome. There never was a 2007 motorhome. Counsel persists in arguing that there was a motorhome that they inspected and that it was a 2003. Again, I want to clarify the record here. There is testimony that Mr. Hintz, the loan officer, went down to inspect a motorhome. There is no evidence, competent evidence, that shows what that motorhome was. The affidavit that was submitted said there were a number of motor recreation vehicles that were repossessed, and one of them had was apparently a 2003 motorhome. One of them. But no one could testify that Mr. Hintz walked through that particular 2003, another 2003, or some other motorhome altogether that wasn't repossessed. We frankly don't know.
Who does it matter?
In my view, it doesn't matter. But just to address his point, when the bank says that the collateral existed, in fact, it doesn't exist. Indeed, what the bank has identified as its collateral in this case, in the loan documents and the proof of loss to us, was a 2007 motorhome. And it will have to concede that that 2007 motorhome, as described in the counterfeit certificate of origin, does not exist. So again, I go back to the 2007 fake certificate of origin is a fabrication, as much as the 2007 motorhome it purports to describe. Neither existed. Now, to go on to the good faith point, Judge, again, what makes this particularly reckless is that Mr. Hintz, not only did the bank make no attempt to verify that the representations in the certificate of origin were genuine in any part, which they could have done, by the way. They asked for a load of information from Mr. Ott. 2 years of personal business tax returns, a financial statement. They did and what they would describe as exhaustive underwriting. And they knew that Mr. Ott would be the one producing the one document to verify the asset he was purchasing. And the one document they would need to have a valid security interest to go to your point, Judge. They knew that they had it, but they did nothing. They were satisfied leaving the certificate of origin unchecked. They send Mr. Hintz down. Mr. Hintz testified, clearly, he couldn't distinguish between any brands of Monaco coach motorhomes. He couldn't even confirm that the one that was shown to him was a new 2007 Beaver Marquis.
Well, he assumed it was.
He just assumed it was. He took Ott's representations exclusively that it was. And this is where the Fifth Circuit has addressed this point. A bank customer who comes in and produces a document to you And the Fifth Circuit case was Marsh Investment Corp. v. Lankford. The bank customer came in and produced a corporate resolution and shareholder consents that basically said, this man has the authority to mortgage this property. Turned out to be completely bogus. When the bank sustained a loss when there was a default, the court said the bank can't say it was operating in good faith. It opted to remain selectively ignorant, was the way they phrased it. And that's precisely what we have here. Selectively ignorant as to the veracity of those documents, when they could have easily just lifted a finger and verified the contents of those documents.
Of course, with the mortgage, you've got a title search, and it's recorded, and you have obvious, you can look independently and know whether there's a prior lien on it or whether it's correctly described and all that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Of course, but what the specific documents they were relying on there to issue a loan was his authority, and the Fifth Circuit made that clear. The bank was relying on his authority to make this loan, and that was the corporate resolution and the shareholder consent that purported to give him that authority. And they said, and the Fifth Circuit was clear: you can't remain selectively ignorant. Here, had the bank lifted a finger, to use the Fifth Circuit's terms, and just to verify, it would have found out immediately that this certificate of origin, to go to Judge Magnuson Stinson's point, doesn't even remotely look like a genuine original.
Was the Fifth Circuit case a summary judgment affirmance, or was it post-trial?
Your Honor, I believe it was a summary judgment case, but I don't want to represent that. I'm certain on that.
So where would they go for the certificate of origin that you say they should have gone for?
Your Honor, they could have done many things. They could have the loan documents recited the number of what was supposedly the VIN in the recreational vehicle. So they had that VIN number before closing. They knew the manufacturer. They could have contacted the manufacturer, which is precisely what the investigators did, to quickly learn no such VIN exists. This manufacturer didn't produce or manufacture any such motorhome. Alternatively, they could.
That's the custom and usage in the loans in this industry. If you go to a dealer and like in a floor plan, I assume it goes on in motorhomes as it does in automobile business. And banks lend on a rotating basis all the time, and based it on, I'm assuming, documentation is presented by the dealership. Do you think the custom usage is to go to the manufacturer, General Motors, Chrysler, whatever, and check to see whether that VIN exists?
You know, Your Honor, perhaps it should be. But the fact
You're suggesting it's not a good faith effort here by the bank.
Sure. And to that point, I was going to follow up and just say, perhaps it should be, but, you know, Your Honor, we're not arguing that there should be some industry-wide standard or that they deviated from an industry-wide standard. We don't have to, and we're not asking the court to issue a blanket ruling on that point. We're saying under these particular circumstances where the bank concedes there was a red flag here, and that they concede it required extra care, knowing that Ott was the one, not some third party in a normal dealership transaction, Your Honor. For example, whether one of us were to go purchase a car, we're not the dealer, we're not the buyer and dealer. We don't control the certificate of origin. That's an independent third party. That would be a dealer. And presumably that's what the bank was, when the bank says it was operating under its own loan procedures and that should be sufficient. Well, this was not a typical loan situation.
But why wouldn't their conduct be more appropriate for disposition by the trier of fact, whether it's a bench trial or a jury? You're seeking a judgment on this issue, and it seems pretty fact-sensitive to me.
Well, at the outset, the threshold issue is dispositive because there is no dispute. So the Seventh Circuit ought to affirm the district court's ruling on that point. But if it had to go further, again, none of the underlying facts are disputed as to the good faith, not one. They concede they did nothing in the wake of having all this information that they could have easily followed up on. Their simple point is, we didn't have a duty. We were under no obligation to do that. That's their point. But again, they do not dispute any of the district court's findings, key findings, which said you didn't complete an investigation here. Okay. Court has anything else, I'll follow up.
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you.
You see, I think your time had expired, but we asked a substantial number of questions, so you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal. You reserved 5 minutes, but but you used up all the time. When you go into when the white light's on, when the white light's on, you're into rebuttal time. But I appreciate you may not have appreciated that, so you may have 2 minutes.
I appreciate the court's indulgence. I want to get to this issue of the bank having conceded it did nothing. That is absolutely, positively not true. The bank doesn't concede that it did nothing. The bank concedes that it did not call Monaco. And what the bank has also submitted is the affidavit of Jim Saladin saying that we didn't do it. He's been in the banking industry 25 years, and nobody else does it. The other thing here is there is a deafening silence in the affidavit of Michael Hayes. Michael Hayes is the senior counsel at Monaco who wrote the letter to the bank's third investigator. So it's not like just the bank hired one investigator. They came back and said, oh, yeah, this VIN number doesn't exist. It took the third investigator to uncover this situation. But Michael Hayes wrote the letter in response to the investigator after it was already sent to another individual. And I guess here's my point, that if there was a standard, easy, a call line, a hotline for Monaco, that, yes, we're equipped and it's an ordinary part of our practice and procedure, we get calls like this all the time, one would have expected to see that in the Hayes affidavit. But I think the fact that we don't see that is telling, and it supports the position of the bank, that that's not the ordinary procedure. And it's one thing for admittedly smart bond lawyers to come up and say, well, the bank could have done X, Y, and Z after the fact. They could have called Monaco. But it's another thing to have that actual requirement written into the bond. And I would submit to the court that there's no way to impose the duty. We're not just saying we didn't do it. We acknowledge we didn't call Monaco. There was no duty to call Monaco because that's not part of the standard practice. But you can't.
How do you respond to counsel's point, though, that this wasn't a standard case? It wasn't a standard loan. It was an extraordinary situation by the bank's own description.
I don't believe our word was extraordinary. Our word was unique, but that, okay. We would concede that it's unique. And what the uniqueness of this loan dictated was that the bank sent somebody down to Ott's dealership to physically inspect the motorhome prior to closing the loan and to take pictures of it and to physically get the certificate of origin from Mr. Ott, so that the bank's representatives and personnel could submit the certificate of origin to the state to get the title. I see that my time is up.
Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you.
The case
you,
is taken under advisement.